Accession number 10767, rule 17.
Mr. Joe Fitzpatrick, Reel 17. We were talking about your sporting activities, or the sporting activities at Saltow, and you were talking about the football team. Was there anything else you remember about the football?
Yes, Huey Dixon, he come from Darlington, and he was a very classic player. And as I told you, years afterwards, a friend of mine went and saw him. And one day afternoon, I found that there was, I always work night work, and Darlington were playing all the Mathletic and Boundary Park. So I got on the train and I went. And at half time, as they're going in the tunnel, I shouted, "Huey!" And I was only 10 yards. He said, "Hello, Fitz, how are you?" I said, "Lovely." And I said, "Nice to see you, Huey." And of course, he was sweating, you know. So he said, "I'll have to dash in, Joe." I said, "That's good." And I never saw him again. And the other chap that was a brilliant player, he signed on for Sunderland. And he got transferred to Fulham. And as I remember, a good few years ago now, that... the gentleman that wrote the first mile, do you know his name?
Bannister.
Bannister was on the radio and he was asked a question, who was the fastest sportsman that you've seen, with the ball or without the ball or anything? And he said, the one that I think was the fastest man was Barney Hudson. And of course I pricked my ears up. I said, blimey, he said, I think he'd be about right and all, because I've seen them all, But anyway, one day Fulham was playing a team called South Shields. And in that team, they had two fullbacks, Creswell and... we call it Shadwell, I think it was something like that, Shadwell. Shadwell and Creswell. Well, Creswell... brought the referee and claimed that Barney had tried to bribe them. Well, a few weeks after Barney was suspended, signed eye. So that was his football career over. But Creswell, captained England when he was playing for Everton, and captained Everton, and he was a really good fullback. But that's it. That was the end of the two of the best footballers that was in the camp.
Was it a very high standard, the team, then? Got two professional footballers in it?
Well, they weren't professional then, you know, but they did reach professionalism, and I think that 9 out of 10 of them was good enough.
How were you picked? So were the teams picked, then? It doesn't sound like just anybody could play.
If they were good enough.
So who picked the teams?
Well... I suppose the Aussies, the regimental sergeant major, and one or two others had picked the team. It didn't need picking, the teams were there.
What would happen if somebody else wanted to play football? Who wasn't
well,
that
then,
good?
Well, then, they'd accommodate them. And whoever was the best would play.
But that's what I mean, whoever was the best would play. What happened if some ordinary players who weren't very good wanted to play? Were they allowed to play?
Well, they'd have to play. They'd have to prove themselves to a certain extent. But a lot of them didn't want to bother. Say of a Sunday morning when I was having a walk round, a Russian would perhaps say to me in action, "What time do I kick off?" And I'd put three fingers up, point to my wrist watch, 3 o'clock, and the Russians would be there an hour and a half before the start of the game. I sat on the little stools, 6 foot deep and 2 yards off the line. Which you've seen the pictures of.
So it was very popular, these matches.
They loved it. They loved it. Beautiful. And we loved it as well.
What other sport then? You mentioned the track events and
rugby union. I only just watch them now and again. They're not tell out of each other. which I like to watch, and I like everything, any kind of sport. But those are the two main things as regards sport and regards recreation.
Would there be any casual kickabouts, you know, just amongst three or four men having a kickabout?
Oh, yes. Well, they could get a ball and have a kick shooting in and all that. Oh, yes, if they wanted to.
Was there any sort of cinema or theatre there?
Yes. We had a hut and it was turned into a cinema, and they showed one or two films of that time. And, of course, it might be in English, it might be in French or Flemish or anything. But they used to have one or two good artists, which pictures I've got, such as Atrod and Co, that's Hatton and Rudd and Collins, doing a bit of acrobating. And then there was a couple of Australians, one dressed as a tennis player in long skirts, and the other one with the old straw hat and whatnot. They give a turn.
So the same hut was used for the cinema as the theatre?
Oh, yes, the same hut.
Where did this...
And also, we had an orchestra.
I'll come... Where did they get the stuff for the cinema, the
projector? They'd send them from home for them. They'd send them from home. They'd ask for, a wig or whatever they wanted.
What about a projector? That's a bit more...
Projectors? Well, of course, they'd find some way or another of getting that from home. And they'd probably have an idea of how to fix it and whatnot.
So it was all sent from
Britain? Mind you this, you know, that the people, French and Belgians, you know, they may be the people that were able to attend to this equipment.
How often would the film shows be?
Oh, yeah, an hour or so.
And how often?
Oh, about, you might get once a fortnight of that, and an entertainment. And they also had a little orchestra.
And their instruments came from home again?
Yes.
What sort of stuff would they do?
Oh, playing the violin, playing the cornet. Oh, yes. And a Joanna. Oh, we were short of nothing we had.
And so there was a regular programme of... How were they advertised in the camp? Would they have a camp newspaper or camp bulletin board or anything?
On the latrines, everybody had a section, and they had their own notice board. And we never had it, but you could go to the French and read it, and you'd know very well what would be on that night if you wanted to go.
So that's where it would be advertised?
That's right.
Now, you mentioned earlier...
But it didn't take long, you know, for it to pass round.
And so that was a regular programme of events. Was there any educational thing going on?
No.
No lectures?
No, and that is where I should have... Mind you this, I could make myself understand in German or a little bit of French. But I should have... If I had my time to go over again, I should learn at least six languages. Because I think it's essential.
But there was nothing taught there?
No, you had to do... I could have sent for a French dictionary or an English dictionary or anything that I wanted, and they would have sent it me.
Did anybody take... I mean, in the Second World War, people took professional exams in prisoner of war camps. Was there any educational provision like that there for people to study, say, law or accountancy?
Not then. Not in those days.
So there was no educational side at all?
No organisation for education or anything.
What about books? Did you have any sort of library or...
No.
Nothing to read then?
If we'd have had all these things, we wouldn't have wanted to go home.
So you had a cinema, but you didn't get books from home?
No.
Could you? Is that because you didn't ask for them, or...?
Well, I suppose so. Oh, I'd sort of send them if you wanted them.
But you didn't miss them?
No.
What about... your knowledge of what was going on, you know, the war. You mentioned this map that was up.
Yeah.
What other sources of information did you have for the war?
Well, if you've got friends in the administration there, they came out and you don't think me to tell me, they wouldn't tell you. And that's how we got to know.
And how did you feel?
As I found out when war was signed, the peace was signed, I said I read it on the French notice board. And that was at 9 o'clock in the morning. And it said armistice will be signed at 11 o'clock on the 11th of the 11th at 11 o'clock.
So you knew 2 hours before?
Huh?
You knew 2 hours before?
Yeah. Did you? Oh, that's me. Yes.
So
I went back and told my maid.
And it was accurate information then?
I went back and told my maid, and nobody made a murmur. Just took it as that's that. Yeah.
Was there any sort of celebration on Armistice Day?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever.
What did the Germans do?
Well, they do nothing.
Did they leave the camp, though?
In fact, I think they were very pleased with themselves. They were very pleased that it was over and they'd suffered enough. I think, that's what I think. And then again, we didn't know when we would get taken back on our journey home. And that was November the 11th. Well, December the 11th passed.
What did you do in that month? Did life just go on as before?
Oh, just lolled about, you know, just carried on as ordinary.
Were the Germans still running the camp, or did...
Oh, yes, they're still there, you know.
So for a month it carried on.
But when the what's the name, I mean, say you was a freelance, then you could have gone out and had a walk round the town, or which was 4 miles away, but you didn't want to bother with that. You could have gone anywhere, they wouldn't have stopped you. Or they might have just pulled you up and said, no, don't do that, stay where you are, you know, because they didn't know what you were up to or anything like that. Oh, no, there was more or less, in fact, the nation was starving, and they showed it too.
How did it show?
In the face and the body.
You mean they were becoming thin?
Hungry. They were hungry.
Did any of the prisoners use their... you know, their parcels on the black market, or to get things?
Well, they may have done. I wouldn't have been surprised. I would have done if I'd have known that they weren't required, or which they weren't required. I'd have given the old commandant, I'd have given them a parcel on the quiet. A bit of human nature in me.
So you'd have given it away?
Yeah.
You mean,
yeah, well, because for the simple reason this, it would be left there and Tom, Dick and Harry would get it. They was able to have access to it.
But you wouldn't have sold it for profit?
No. No, what good would it do you? It do no good, that.
So what happened next? So you got to December the 11th?
Yeah, and then we were told we're going on the 23rd. Of December, and at last, an old Joseph, there was a railway siding along the camp, and I got aboard and I stood there talking to old Joseph, and he was crying. Well, I kissed him goodbye on his cheek, you know, and, as the French do, and I parted from him. I never saw him again, and I regret that very much indeed, but still, what's gone's gone. Can't be replaced. And we eventually got to Hamburg, which is about 3 hours' ride away, and coming along the dockside, those chaps that had been a prisoner of war for so long, 1914 and so-and-so, well, they were due lally. And when they saw the Marines on patrolling the dock, they made a BI for them and hugged them and kissed them and the captain of the Marines come along and said, now boys, go on, do you want to go home? Get back to your place, he said, or else you'll not get on the boat. And they quietened down then. And we went on board. And I got a nice little corner. And we set sail. And we got off Heligoland. And we had dreadnoughts circling round and whatnot, and a Royal Marine officer taking pots at mines and whatnot, and with a rifle. And we anchored off Heligoland, and we were there for 48 hours. Rough sea. Don't take the risk. And while we were there, we got fully equipped with khaki, everything, boots and all, new boots, you couldn't wear the old boots, and it was stacked on the deck. Oh, the captain took, instead of taking 1,200, he took 1,800 of us. There was a board that shouldn't have been. Anyway,
so these were from all over Germany, these POWs, not just from Soltau?
Oh, no, they're coming from all directions. And the equipment and boats and stuff, it towered up like a big, I was going to say Printer's Pie, but up in a big heap, a right big heap, as big as this house of stuff. And then when we got out onto the North Sea, it was all dumped overboard. So I had the job of getting all of a bit of blacking and blacking my boots because it was raw leather. And it was a lovely, nice change. And while I was aboard, I altered my trousers so that I could look neat with the putties coming over, narrowing the leg a bit. Oh, I'm pretty good with the needle, needle and thread. And we got to Hull on the 26th. Yes, that's right. And as we went going up the Humber, all the boats were giving us the old singing, da da da, ha ha ha, you know. And it was a warm welcome they gave us. We docked, and alongside the dock they were issuing mugs of tea and a bit of cake, and then they give you two postcards. So I filled the postcards up, one to my mother and one to my friend in Colchester. And we eventually finished up at Catterick. And as I told you at Catterick, that Tommy Johnson gave me £1 to have a drink, services rendered, and we got some pay and instructions that in case of emergency and recall up where we would have to report, Eaton Park, Manchester. And it was set off for home.
Well, had you actually been demobilised then?
Demobilised then.
And what was that date?
We got some money.
Would that be in January?
No, before January. The 23rd when we got there. We only stayed about 24 hours there at Catterick. It'd be somewhere about the 28th. I know, just before 2 or 3 days after Christmas Day. 3 days after Christmas Day. And we got there. Well, I was on 2 months demob, you see. And while I was on demob leave, a Canadian sergeant, who was a prisoner of war, and a chap out of the Lancers, 17th Lancers or something with his spurs or whatnot, a sergeant, came to see me. They were staying at the Midland Hotel. So I went down to their room and we had a couple of nights together, like going out for a drink and that. And then the horseman had to go back to London, and then the day afterwards this Canadian went back. He'd be on his way home. And all I did was to light her about a bit. But after about a week, I made inquiries and I'd got to go to Preston for a settlement of the money. And I made an allowance to my mother, which will astonish you, that in Grove River we were lined up and we were asked the question, how much allowance are you making to your dependents? And I said, 3 parts to my mother, you see. That was 9 pence a day. And that left myself with 1 and 9 pence a week. So ultimately there was a... They did me. Didn't be because I didn't smoke, didn't drink only now and again. And I thought, well, what I could do, she always came first. And I don't know, I got to, when I came home, my mother said, who's this girl in Colchester? Oh, I laughed. I said, oh, I can see how it is. Well, I said, I had 2 cards, one for you and one for her. I said, because I said, you've been... She'd been an excellent friend, I said. Nothing more, but an excellent friend, I said. And she, I think she'd been really great. I said, and she'd get her card a day before you because it wasn't far from home, you see. I said, she'd let you know that I'm in England. Say, oh, I see, yes. So I had to laugh at the old Dutch. And I decided to go to Preston, and it was on the main street there, next to the Empire Theatre. It used to be there. And the clerk there was telling me what he had to do to pass to get this job as a clerk, writing on blotting paper with ink, you know. I said, by gum, I said, that must have been hard work, that. He said, it was. He didn't know that I was kidding him a bit, you know. And it eventually reckoned up and he paid me. So I said, have you got some place that's got the Croix de Guerre decorations for the... oh, yes, he said, you go down here and you take the first to the right and then it's about 100 yards up and it's elephant hut. See, a row of elephant huts a bit. So I found this place and a girl came. So I said, my name's so-and-so and I believe you've got in storage my Croix de Guerre. She said, that's great. So, do you want it? I said, yes, please. So I said, that was how I received my Croix de Guerre from a lady. I said, no bands playing or anything. I said, so I was quite pleased, satisfied. And eventually, about 3 weeks afterwards, I was nearly skint then, and a letter came from Preston saying that I'd been overpaid £17. Well, you see, the stupid devil is that much of importance in himself that he'd wrecked me on sergeant's pay instead of only a quarter of it. Got me? So, will you please refund the money?
Because the other 3 quarters had been going to your mother.
That's right. He said, would I refund the money? And I said, oh, yes. And I got over it and I threw it on the back of the fire. And that was the end of that.
You ignored it?
Yes.
Yeah. When you came out of the army, you know, in December 1918, January, and then into January, you said you were healthy in POW camp in Saltau, but had it affected you, was your health all right? Had you lost weight or anything?
No.
So you were in what you'd call your normal form?
Yes.
You just like normal?
Absolutely. Might have been a bit paler, but not much. But, no.
What did you reckon on getting a job again, then? When did you start
well,
looking?
Well, the job I had was at the Co-op in Low Broughton, at the mantle factory in the cloth department. Well, that was useless, you see.
Did you try and get back there?
Oh, I went back eventually. Oh, my job was there for me.
They had kept it for you?
Oh, yeah, well, they paid part of my wages, you see. To my mother. See, they were a good firm to work for, with the Co-op.
So what was wrong when you went back there? What month did you go back there?
January. Well, I should say I went back in February.
So you had about 6-7 weeks off then?
Yes, about 6 weeks off.
And what happened when you went back? Why wasn't it satisfactory?
Well, the wages weren't big enough for me. See? Mind you, this job was easy and whatnot. But a boy could have done it, you know, like Burma. So, but eventually...
You felt you'd outgrown the job then?
I wanted more cash. The only way to get more cash was to leave it. Get wandering.
So when did you leave?
Well, I left after about a fortnight or so, and I had three brothers, in the printing lot, you know, and I managed to get an interview with the Nat Soper. Which is now called SOGAT.
The union?
Yes, printing union. And I got a card, and I got employed at Withy Grove.
Which what?
Withy Grove, Manchester. Withy Grove, Manchester. It was the largest printing office in the world at that time.
And what was your job there?
Well, I was a printer's labourer, really. See? And it was just the job I wanted. And the money was good. See? And so, one of the overseers there, I don't know whether... Oh, Dixon, I had on guard at Hazelbrook, he was working there. And he worked for a few years, and then I think he snuffed it. But a good few years after, what's his name? George Dixon from Ordsall Lane, Salford. And this overseer, he didn't have to give me some dirty jobs. And you know what he was doing? He was taking the mickey out of the sergeant. Definitely. And if I'd have had a row with him, I'd have bloody told him, you know, you're taking the mickey. Not that I didn't grumble. I could do the job. And I worked hard. I could do the job.
Did you get promotion?
Yes. Well, you move up, you see. You start as a fly hand. That's taking the papers along. Now they only just turn them. They go on an escalator into the publishing room now. You see, they used to go up a belt at one time. And then I got on to the rolls, getting the rolls of paper ready. And then I got on to the oil can. And then I got on to, while I was on the oil can, two years afterwards, the Daily News folded up in Dale Street, Manchester. And a lot of them come. Well, we weren't fully qualified full card men then. Somebody had overlooked it, you see, or did it on purpose. And there was quite a crowd of us started at that area. There was one lad named Barrett, and I'm cleaning the machine one morning, and he come to me and he said, "Hey, Fitz, weren't you at Salto?" So I said, "Aye." He said, "Don't you remember me?" He said, "The fellow with the Scotch hat on, Glengarry." "Oh, it was you, was it?" And he said, "Of course it was me." And we worked together for many years afterwards, and he died young, as I might say. He died in the 50s.
So you settled in.
It just shows you. And that Jack Wright came back there, that was in Wimmeroo Hospital from the Canadians. He was in that business.
So you stayed in the printing trade, did you?
Oh, yes. And in what they call a new cellar, and it really wasn't a success because of the foundation. And the minder, they call the minder, he used to get the what they call a special post order. That was a certain amount of wires.